You know, humans all over the world, throughout recorded history and likely in prehistoric times, have reported encounters with strange non-human beings. They've appeared in different forms, acted in different ways, and we have so many different names for them. Angels, demons, fairies, elves, trolls, goblins, ghosts, cryptids of different kinds, aliens, ETs. But is there a common denominator? Rather than being many different beings, could they all be the same intelligence, one that appears to us in different forms at different times, something ancient that has always lived here, something that's not from other planets, but something like crypto-terrestrials? That is the premise of Ryan Musgrave Evans' book, Children of Orion, Finding the Crypto-Terrestrials. We go down under and talk to Ryan right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Ryan Musgrave Evans is a lifelong experiencer of what he thinks is crypto-terrestrial contact. He claims to know intimately a race of future humans called the Magina or Wandina that live beneath our oceans and within our mountains, and he writes about them in his new book, Children of Orion, Finding the Crypto-Terrestrials. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hey, good day, George. Thanks for having me.
Great to talk to you. I enjoyed the book. I mean, you really worked hard on this to draw together a lot of different topics and weave them into an entertaining narrative. I was surprised at the you wait until the end of the book to share about your own personal experiences. I think I'd like to start there, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, for sure.
So you've had basically a lifetime of experiences. Walk us through it. When did they start and in what form? And then tell us how it expanded over the years.
Okay, yeah, sure. Well, I've had sporadic contact all through my life from a very young age. And it sort of it escalated and became very powerful and very frequent in just recent years, in, say, 2013 or 2014. But I have had a lot of experiences otherwise over my life as well, and experiences of being a child and waking up in the middle of the night, wandering about my house, not being able to wake my parents or siblings, with them just completely comatose, to wander outside to see luminous beings leaping and floating through the yard, that things that I thought were like harlequins at the time. Once in particular, when I went outside and felt summoned outside, my dad used to build boats, and there was a 50-foot concrete reinforced boat sitting in our front yard. I wandered over to that, and there was a dark shape on top of it, and the shape jumped down onto me and swept me up into something that was like a sack. And I was hysterical. It seemed to levitate off with me and then opened the sack again and even, like, stroked my face to try and calm me, it seemed, before I woke up hysterical again at home with missing time. Now, those kinds of events, there's numerous ones of that kind, but there's one in particular that happened when I was 1 month shy of turning five. And I know particularly when this one happened, because we were down near a local golf course where there was a wood of pine trees that we used to go and visit, and we used to cut a bough off a pine tree every year, illegally, unfortunately, but we used to wander down. And rather than harming any of the actual saplings, we used to take a limb off a tree and drag it back home and pretend it was a real tree and put it for Christmas in a pot with soil. But this one year, we were down there engaged in this, and my siblings had jumped the fence and gone into the wood of, like, North American pine trees. My mother and my younger brother and myself were still there outside the fence, and it was broad daylight, summer, beautiful blue sky. There, 20 or 30 foot away or so, there was a triangular-shaped head, long fingers reaching around the tree, huge black eyes. It's sort of like a ridge-like pattern to the top of the head. High cheekbones. And at the time, even then, I thought, this looks like a mask. It doesn't really look like a being itself. It looks like a mask. Its body seemed to be comprised of a texture that was like the tree itself, like the bark of the pine tree. And I said to my mum, what is that? What is that there? And she said, oh, that's your brothers and sisters. And they were much further on again. And I was like, no, what is that? And it went behind the tree, peered again from the other side. She couldn't see it. My siblings came back at the tree, walked straight past it, couldn't see it themselves. After that episode, I became obsessed with the ideas about fairies and owls, because I decided this might be some kind of tree spirit. And for many years afterwards, I intensely focused on researching Celtic fairy faith and tree spirits and things like this. But when I was a teenager, I had a fair few interesting experiences as well of a poltergeist nature. When I was in my 20s, I had some pretty intense experiences happening in the middle of the night, waking up with tall, fair people in my room. One in particular woke up and there was a girl crouched down beside my bed staring in my face. And it's a bit embarrassing to admit, but I actually lashed out at her and tried to kick at her, and she shot off around the end of the bed and shot out the wall, like she was intangible in some way.
You had an encounter when you were 21 years old out in a forest with a little girl, and then there were a bunch of voices that you say in your book. They're not true, hallucinatory. Right. Tell me about that.
I went camping into the Sherbrooke Forest in the Dandenong Ranges that are east of Melbourne, big eucalypt forest, national park. And I had an experience where while I was camping, I pitched a tent underneath these trees, and there were lights I could see through the forest. There was movement. It was a very windy night as well, so I was trying to figure out if these sounds were like branches falling or what was going on. But then I could hear distinct footsteps running around the tent, putting their hands on the tent, and light, like will-o'-wisp, moving in and about the trees. Then I had an interesting experience where there seemed to be like a silent voice that sounded like it was... It's very difficult to explain, and I have this a lot since, but it's like a... It is 3D. It's almost like it's physical. And it isn't like a text, like in the sense that you're seeing writing that's 3D in your mind or something like that. No, it seems it's linguistic, but it's silent. So it seems to be incorporating English or Gaelic as well, because I speak Gaelic, so sometimes they use that. But like a packet of information, like a sentence that's projected and articulated much faster than a person could actually express it, so verbally, but nonetheless linguistic. And I had that starting to happen. Then I had missing time. And the next day, while I was wandering down off the mountain, there was a girl, a little blonde girl, off in the middle of a national park, which was bizarre, watching me from behind bracken. Now, this is all linked. This is all part of the same kind of people, the same experiences that intensified as I got older, and particularly when I moved back to where I'd originally come from, the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria.
So you've had these experiences, you're trying to make sense of them and figure out where they came from, how they fit into your life. You even write that they had nicknames for you, that was communication, that they had two different nicknames for you. Can you share those with us?
Needle in a haystack.
Needle in a haystack, right?
Yeah. Clever monkey.
Clever monkey. That's a good one.
Quite patronizing, yeah.
I don't think it's supposed to be
an endearment, but it comes across as being quite patronizing. Little Irishman, they've called me as well, and that's because I speak Gaelic and I speak it to my kids. And sometimes they even use that as a language with me. They also have another language that sounds, to my ear, most like Japanese. That is their native language. But I thought it was Japanese at first when they first started using it with me. I can't understand it, though. But sometimes I hear them speaking to each other, or one of them... when I was in bed, knelt down and started speaking it to me at the back of my head. And I'm not quite sure whether that was ritualistic or whether she was talking to someone else that happened to be in the room and not me. But their actual native language sounds kind of like Japanese with some sort of like barking sounds mixed into it. The Sierra sounds are typical of the way they sound. The Sierra sounds are definitely not Sasquatch. But the Sierra sounds that are recorded by Ron Moorhead and Al Berry in the 70s in the Sierra Nevada mountains, they are typical of Mudgeena or Tall Whites. They are the same beings that Charles Hall describes in his Millennial Hospitality books, where he claims to have been posted at Nellis Air Force Base in the 60s and as a weather observer. He claims to have had prolonged and regular contact with a group of tall, fair beings that would chirp and bark that lived in the mountains there, that would manipulate his mind, leaving with missing times, intensely, curiously investigate his property. These are the same kinds of beings that, I've experienced in my life, and much more recently, a lot.
Okay. Hold on a second. We'll come back to Charles Hall. I want to sort of lead up to that because it's such a central part of what you write. You've had a lifetime of these experiences, trying to make sense of it, figure out what these things are, and you do a great job of going back in history to read about and incorporate stories of elves and fairies and things that we consider folklore, but which have a remarkable similarity to what we now call aliens. And, you know, as, of course, as you note in your book, Jacques Vallée and John Keel were some of the early researchers, both of those names we respect greatly, who differentiated between UFOs, ETs, and these other beings that they believed had been here a long time, that it was not easily explained as extraterrestrial visitors popping in for a quick trip to Earth, but rather something that's been here for a very long time, maybe always. So why don't we start there? The idea of crypto-terrestrials, which has been mentioned, as you note, by Mac Tawney's and others who use that term. When did you come across that term, and when did you decide that it sort of fits with what had happened to you?
Yeah. When exactly did I come across Mac Tawney's? I'm not 100% sure. It was a few years ago when I bought his book, The Crypto-Terrestrials, A Meditation on Indigenous Humanoids and the Aliens Among Us. So Mac Tawney's unfortunately passed away at a very young age in 2009, but he'd formulated this alternative hypothesis to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. He called it the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis. The extraterrestrial hypothesis, Mac Tawney's decided, was dogmatic. It was a presumption of many people that if the UFO phenomenon was not made by us, Homo sapiens, and was a real thing, that therefore it followed it must be extraterrestrial. And this really didn't sit well with Mac Tawney's. Now, so he launched this alternative hypothesis that was a thought experiment to him. He didn't necessarily believe these beings existed, but he just wanted to offer it as an alternative system to make ufology that much richer and more complex, I suppose, to make it less dogmatic, and often people come into ufology a couple of different ideas of the possibility of what these beings are. So he speculated that maybe the beings behind the UFO phenomenon, the close encounter phenomena, abduction phenomena, are indigenous humanoids to this planet rather than being extraterrestrial or extrasolar. Even most often when people talk about extraterrestrials, they even go further and suggested they're from beyond our solar system, of course. But to Mac Tawney, well, that didn't really fit that well with him because of the recurring theme in abduction, UFO abduction law, often returned to, where the beings would appear to be interested in our genetics, perhaps sometimes even attempting hybridization, perhaps sometimes even copulating with us in the old-fashioned way, like in interbreeding, like in the case, the famous case from Brazil, 1957, Antonio Velas Bolas, or the a similar case from Sydney, Australia in 1992 with Peter Curry. But these things just seem to have a close genetic affiliation with us, so close that maybe you could even consider them to be a subspecies, some kind of sister race at least, and that this was strongly indicative of them being originally from here. Now, in my book, as I move through different cases through history, it comes to the fore that the beings have a relationship with Orion. Anyway, I'll put it that way, particularly Orion's belt. Now, some people might think about the word crypto-terrestrial, and especially those people that were familiar with the term before listening tonight, they might have thought the title of my book is a contradiction and say, how could these beings be children of Orion? And Orion, of course, is an extrasolar constellation. How could they be from Orion and still somehow be indigenous to this Earth? What I try to show in the book is that although they were originally from here, they've spent vast amounts of time away and they've returned. So they have a relationship with Orion, even though they are still, strictly speaking, categorizable as crypto-terrestrials because they still are a sister species and indigenous to Earth. But the crypto-terrestrial idea, I just felt that it was perhaps the most appropriate term for them. Matt Kennedy's built into the definition of the word an understanding that there's sort of a departure from Jacques Vallée's ideas. I'm not quite sure what Jacques Vallée says nowadays, but certainly his earlier books that I've read, Passport to Medonia and Dimensions, and he talks about how there seems to be some kind of maybe metaphysical or paraphysical element, maybe some kind of multidimensional element to the beings, to the euphonauts behind the UFO phenomenon, and that maybe they are intrinsically somehow unknowable to us in some way or beyond our understanding. Whereas Max Tony's departed again from Jacques Vallée, even though he agreed that there seemed to be a continuum of experience from the older fairy lore to UFO lore of today, and there seemed to be evidence to suggest that they're identical beings from earlier times to modern, he still felt that there was no need to suggest they were anything other than flesh and blood beings related to us with nuts and bolts technology. And so that's my book carries on from Max Tony's in that sense. I argue and try to show that they are very similar to us in that respect. They may have very robust technologies that can allow them apparent magical abilities or paraphysical abilities, or perhaps they can utilize vortices or portals. Perhaps they can make themselves intangible and pass through solid objects. Perhaps they are interdimensional when they want to be. But nonetheless, primarily they are the bone of our bone. They are us, of a kind. Very similar to us. Anyway.
The argument has been made by skeptics, and I can understand their skepticism, that these stories about aliens and humans creating hybrids, or people being abducted by these other ETs for genetic material that can help create a hybrid, was ridiculous, because if they're really from somewhere else, they can't possibly mate with us. Your suggestion is they're not from somewhere else, they're from here, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's what Max Tony had suggested, and that is what I have come to know as well. Now, I have a lot of experience with these beings as well, which is something I sort of keep out of the book. I try to be as objective as possible until the end of the book and try to make it as difficult to be as objective as I've tried to be, being an experiencer of the beings that I am investigating. But nonetheless, I've tried to sort of step aside and by using inductive and deductive reasoning and profiling. I'm using what I call a CT profile, a crypto-terrestrial profile, where I build up a list of characteristics, compendium of characteristics, traits of the beings, language, appearance, habitation, technologies, behaviors, and then use that list to seek or profile to seek other cases that are likely the same beings, and then these new cases reinform the list and add to it so this compendium expands to get a clearer and clearer understanding of them and their games in play and the way they interact with it.
All right, Ryan Musgrave Evans, I'm going to stop you for a second. We've got to go to a break. Ryan Musgrave Evans, The Children of Orion, Finding the Crypto-Terrestrials is the book. We'll come back in a moment here. We're talking with Ryan Musgrave Evans about Children of Orion, Finding the Crypto-Terrestrials. Not just a theory for him. It's based on a lifetime of strange experiences. We're working on trying to improve the sound of this phone line, so hopefully it'll be a little clearer when we come back. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Ryan, I hope we can hear you more clearly here. You're saying some really interesting stuff about crypto-terrestrials. As we mentioned in the last segment, you use as a starting point some of the work of Jacques Vallée and John Keel. And as you note in your book, Jacques Vallée had said these entities' reported behavior is consistently absurd, as their craft is ludicrous. In numerous instances of verbal communication, their assertions have been systematically misleading. He also says, does this mean we should take their recollections literally? He says, I don't think so. Even though the witnesses, like you, have told the stories of their encounters accurately, that the actual literal events might be different. Are you confident that the things that you recall happening to you are true and they really happened the way you remember them?
I'm not 100% confident about every interaction I have, because they do utilize powerful technologies and manipulation in technology inside their helmets. They're not any more psychic or telepathic than we are, naturally, but they use technologies and they wear these helmets. And Charles Hall himself had described those kind of helmets as well. We've seen them wearing. He said that he called it electronics to aid in this kind of communication. But not only is it for communication, it's also for mental manipulation and what the beings themselves call mesmerization and memory alteration, which they've apologized to me about before, using it on me. What it means is that some of the experiences I have are involve me entering states that are unusual, where I might find myself, after I've been talking to one of them, kneel down and start moving objects around and lining them up in a sort of an obsessive kind of way. That's a recurring kind of mental state where that they seem to use on me as a kind of way of controlling me and moving me away as a threat sometimes. With mesmerization, it means also that they can convince you that they look like something else that they don't. They can produce an effect that's probably something like a doppelganger or something. You could use a word like that, where I've had experiences where I thought I've been talking to one person and it turns out I can't have been. For instance, one particular event, I was talking to my wife in the kitchen at night, and she was leaning against the kitchen bench, the counter, and I was standing opposite her over the other side of the table. We're getting along famously, but I can't remember what the substance of the conversation was. All of a sudden, I started to feel a bit strange, and my mind started clouding over, and I knelt down. I started crawling out of the room, grabbing laundry, rolling up socks, piling, lining them up in this sort of strange, deliberate kind of way. Found myself starting to levitate, was put back into my room over the top of my sleeping wife, who'd actually the whole time been in bed. They landed me back down onto the bed, put me back down onto the bed, but I didn't actually lie down completely, and all of a sudden the control relinquished, so that I had full control and I was fully awake. And then this kind of telepathic communication of the like that I was talking about in the forest when I was 21 and had that communication kind of event. A voice said, and it was a female voice as well, because that's an interesting point about this as well. It can be obvious when it's a female voice or a male voice, or sometimes it's neutral. She said, we just had a date. And all of a sudden, I felt adrenaline pumping up through me. I became incredibly frightened. Since then, I've never been so frightened interacting with them. I don't get that frightened anymore or frightened at all.
So she said, we've just had a date. We've just had a date, meaning you just had a rendezvous.
Yeah, we just had a date. Now, to put this in context, I'd actually put out an invitation because I'd been having incredible experiences of having tabletop procedures, like medical procedures, more typical kind of ET abduction events, with them drilling into the back of my skull and wandering around and checking my teeth and all this kind of stuff. Huge people with really long fingers dressed in medical outfits with their faces, cover over their faces, hoods over the top of their head, And the medics wear these black lenses over their eyes. So even though they normally have big blue eyes, the medics have something like a smart lens or something. So I've seen them take out, I've seen one with one in and while they've still got another one out. But anyway, back to the other thing. So I'd sent out a message and said, instead of these kinds of strange clinical procedures, I don't know what they're for, but could someone come and visit me? You're welcome in my house anytime. Maybe we could have a beer together or a cup of tea or a coffee or something like that. And I just, so I suppose it's almost a CE5, but the human-initiated event that was that seemed to instigate this visitation or date, she called it. So she said, we just had a date, and then I continued to be frightened, and I felt another like shot of adrenaline go through me. And then she said, I roll my eyes at you. And then, and I took that to be like a rebuke, like I should know better than to be that frightened or something like that. And then I could hear someone walking through the house, the front door open, closing, and then walking up the driveway. So then when I thought about what I'd seen, I could punch through the what was a screen memory or something and see her for the way she was in my memory instead of the way I thought she had been. She was tall, easily 6 foot tall, white blonde hair, very big eyes, high cheekbones, tight black outfit with like a circular technology on her chest. And, yeah, she'd been leaning there in the kitchen. But I suppose this might be where the ideas about doppelgangers and things like that stem from, these kinds of manipulative technologies that can convince you of situations that aren't actually real. So with this kind of psychic play or whatever you want to call it, these kinds of mesmerizations, sometimes it is an issue with trying to work out whether what you've seen, whether they actually look like that or not. Now, there's been other times where they've relinquished that kind of control of me and I have actually been in their presence with what I take to be no mesmerization. Here at my house and also away, taken at one stage in a situation that felt like a hospital where they were scanning me and they showed me this scan that I took to be me but upside down, instead of like a green look to it. And they were saying to me, oh, there's not enough time yet for there to be any change, and I don't know what that meant. And there was no mesmerization. It was just totally real. And then they piled me into the back of like an RV-type craft, like a tic-tac, that's what you call. These days people will call them tic-tacs because of all the stuff in the media that nowadays. But originally people usually refer to these kinds of crafts as like RVs. You know, like, as you well know, George, it's the Gormans, that's a pseudonym, I can't remember their real name, sorry, but the Gormans at Skinwalker Ranch seeing these RV crafts, Charles Hall reporting RV craft, like recreational vehicles that can levitate and piloted by giant, huge people, as they were at Skinwalker Ranch as well, a craft like that. So occasionally I have interactions with them that are completely and totally vivid and real. Other times I have interactions with them that are, in a way, sort of dreamlike, although different again. And I'm fairly good, I think, at telling the difference between dreams and reality. I'm an accomplished lucid dreamer. I have been doing that all my life. And a lot of these interactions are of a kind that just is uncategorizable to me. But now that they've explained ideas to me about mesmerization, I understand more.
So a central part of your thesis is looking back. You have a general idea, even though these things can change shapes and are deceptive at times, that you have a general idea about what they look like in an unguarded state. And so you went back through literature and lore, Gaelic, Irish, Scottish literature, looking for comparisons. And you found them of similarities in the forms. They had different names for them back in those days in different countries. Fairies, elves, whatever, but essentially they're the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Gaelic Shinsen or Uishlin, the Gaelic elves or gentry, were a kind of fairy in Gaelic lore that was tall, fair, with float about on the horizon as a luminous blob at dusk, like a will-o-wisp, lived in mountains and in hills, could exercise powers over your mind and use what people used to call in those days a glamour, which would be akin to what we now think of as being mesmerization or screen memories and things like that.
Right.
People losing time from interacting with these beings. These beings as well whistled and chirped to themselves. This is a very, very close description. Those people who are familiar with the testimony of Charles Hall and his Millennial Hospitality memoir that I mentioned earlier on, this is a very close description to what Charles Hall called tall white. And he coined that term, I think, up until the point of his books coming out in the early 2000s, these kinds of beings would more usually have been referred to as Nordic, but post-Charles Hall's books, tall white is another term that's quite commonly used for them in mythology now.
Let's talk about that a little bit. So you think your basic description of these things, you accept that Charles Hall, who wrote, I think, 5 books about the tall whites, yeah, that's the central to your understanding of these beings and your interaction with them. Charles Hall wrote about being a weather observer for the U.S. Air Force here in Nevada for a time at Indian Springs, which is sort of it's part of the Nellis Range, but he was working out of there, and he claims to have had encounters with these beings. He traveled all over the Indian Springs and into the Nellis Range and had multiple encounters and has written about these things. I have never dug into that story. I know I've never tried to interview him. I don't have a real opinion on it. I know that story has been lurking out there, but I haven't really dug into it until I've read your book. So you think that Charles Hall sounds legit?
Oh, yes, definitely. After I'd been having a lot of experiences in around 2013, 2014, and I became drawn to ufology. And then earlier in my life, I'd had a vague general interest in UFOs and ETs, but not really in an in-depth way. Just as a side interest occasionally, maybe at most. But after I had these interactions, I became very passionate, maybe the word's obsessed, with trying to work out what was happening to me, and looked into a couple of different cases, a couple of different claims and people. When I came across the Millennial Hospitality books, I was like, these are my dudes. It's an identical appearance, identical mind states described by Charles Hall when he talks about how they'd interact with him, and his mind even phrased it like would cloud over with, and then he'd have missing time, and he'd try to regain memory sometimes as well by self-hypnosis and things, and I think he had limited success with that. I've tried that kind of thing myself with very limited success, but trying to regain some missing time here and there. But the chirping and barking languages of Charles Hall's tall wife, I've heard them doing that myself. Charles Hall seemed to believe that the chirping, barking, animal-like sounds that he heard from the tall whites were their real natural language. I personally disagree because I've heard them using those sounds, but I've also heard them using a language that sounds much more like our own Homo sapiens languages, but not. And that's what I was describing earlier with the sort of Japanese. That's the closest thing I can think of. The tall white experiencer, Julio Fernandez, that was abducted in Spain in 1978 in a Soria incident, he was taken aboard a craft by tall, fair beings that inspected him and his dog. And he describes, has a wonderful description, that's in some of the Flying Saucer review magazines, I think I found it. This is probably going to go in my second book. I'll put this case in. It's not actually in the book that I've written yet. But he has a wonderful description of their language and talks about how there's sort of like coughing, barking sounds, whistling, but also the sound that to him sounded like a cross between maybe German and Chinese. He said German for its guttural features, Chinese for its monosyllabic nature. And then when he heard some samples of world languages later on, he said, oh, maybe Korean is the closest sounding. And he describes perfectly the way I've heard them speak as well, which, again, I'll repeat that that's what the Sierra sounds are. I'm absolutely 100% convinced. But for those people who are interested in listening to those Sierra sounds and finding them online and listening to them, that's the Tall White. But and interestingly, I'll just add as a side that I had a yarn with Ron Moorhead about this, the guy who recorded the Sierra sounds. And Al Berry and Ron Moorhead recorded them. And I said, what do you think? And he's not going to mind me repeating this because he's on record saying this anyway when David Politis interviewed him first, Missing 411 on The Hunted. He says he doesn't know what was making the sounds. He could hear them, but he couldn't see them. All he knows is that they had big feet. So the Charles Hall's been definitely the same people that I know. Now Charles Hall himself, he didn't know where they were from. He said he would ask them about that kind of thing, and they were evasive. The idea that they might have been originally from Earth didn't occur to him. He presumed them to be extrasolar aliens. He suspected, and it was nothing more than a suspicion, that they might have been from Arcturus system. And he had a couple of reasons for thinking that. Once one of them was looking through the theodolite that he used to use to measure the balloons going across the sky for the wind measurements. And when he went to look through it, it was pointed at Arcturus. So there were a couple of little clues he thought that they might be from Arcturus. But he actually did not know, and he's on record clearly in his book saying that. Now, they're from here, but they have spent considerable time in Orion. And there's a case about just a tall white. They're not very tall, the beings, but it is a tall white case nonetheless, because tall whites take a long time to grow. Beings that are about 5 foot high, but nonetheless they bark, like Charles Hall describes tall whites as doing. Big blue eyes, fair blonde hair. The Antonio Villas Boas case from Brazil. There was a sign. There was what he took to be hieroglyphs above a door to the craft, and this is one of many references in many different cases to Orion's belt. So the hieroglyphs or the writing in the craft, lines and marks and swirls, and three dots that conform to the layout of Orion's belt, which on its own could very easily be a coincidence. But when you take it, when you consider it along with evidence from other cases where the suggestion also is that they're from Orion's belt, it becomes more compelling. But, definitely the same guys. And also Peter Curry's interaction in Australia.
Yeah, that's a good story. We'll come back to that. We got to go to a break, Ryan. We'll come back to the story of Peter Curry because there is some physical evidence that goes along with that. Talking with Ryan Musgrave Evans about Children of Orion, Finding the Crypto-Terrestrials, really interesting book.